You're listening to the Body Pros podcast coverage of CROI 2010, the 17th Conference on Retroviruses and Opportunistic Infections. The conference took place in San Francisco, California, from February 16th through February 19th, 2010.
Hi, I'm Miles Helfand, editorial director of thebodypro.com. The past couple of years have brought with them a slow but steady shift in our perception of the most noteworthy complications that threaten the health of HIV-infected patients in the United States and other developed countries. The annual CROI meeting tends to act as a barometer of sorts of this ever-changing climate in HIV medicine. To help us get a better sense of where the clinical winds are now blowing, I'm pleased to have on the phone one of the top clinician researchers in the field of HIV and antiretroviral-related complications, Pablo Tabas, an associate professor of medicine at the University of Pennsylvania School of Medicine and principal investigator in the Adult AIDS Clinical Trial Unit at UPenn. Dr. Tabas, thank you so much for joining us.
Oh, you're welcome.
So I suppose we should begin with what has become one of the real hot-button issues in HIV or heart, possibly, related complications, the issue of inflammation. What has CROI told us that has hopefully allowed us to maybe wrap our heads around what this is, what it does, and what we can do about it?
Definitely inflammation has been one of the, if not the hottest topic related to HIV in the last couple of years. We know for a fact that patients with HIV, when they are not being treated, they have high levels of inflammation that are associated with high-level viremia. And when we treat them with antiretroviral therapy, those levels of inflammation decrease, but we know, too, that they don't become completely normal. And this residual inflammation, we can call it that way, has been associated with a myriad of complications of HIV. So this residual inflammation, some people have made it responsible for the lack of increase in CD4 cells in some patients. Some people have made it responsible for accelerated progression of atherosclerosis in some individuals, for the accelerated bone loss, for the lack of response to vaccines, for the increased incidence of cancers in patients with HIV. So there has been a lot of focus on trying to understand why these patients have residual levels of inflammation that are not completely corrected with antiretroviral treatment, and what kind of complications, long-term complications, are associated with this residual inflammation.
What kind of research did CROI provide that shed some new light on the subject?
Well, there was a lot of presentations from the UCSF group, from Priscilla Hugh and also Steve Dix and Peter Hunt and other members of the UCSF group. Their focus has been on the role of this residual inflammation in patients treated with antiretroviral therapy, the role that this residual inflammation plays in the progression of atherosclerosis. And they look at this issue in many different ways. They did ultrasounds of the carotids and look at the progression of atherosclerosis in the carotids. They look at the elasticity of the blood vessels in response to this residual inflammation. They look at the effects of starting earlier versus later in the antiretroviral therapy and what are the effects on these surrogate markers of atherosclerosis. And I think the general theme of their studies is that patients with HIV infection, in spite of having good control of antiretroviral replication, they have these increased levels of inflammation, and those levels are associated with a more rapid progression of atherosclerosis measured by these different surrogate markers. There has been not a lot of studies presented from that group of what to do about it. There was a study that looked at the effects of valganciclovir, which is a treatment for cytomegalovirus, because there was a previous study from the same group showing that a lot of the immune responses of patients with well-controlled HIV go for cytomegalovirus. So the hypothesis was that if you control cytomegalovirus replication, you would decrease the level of inflammation. They did a study and they gave valganciclovir to patients with well-controlled HIV, and really they didn't see a lot of difference in the residual levels of inflammation. They have also tried to intensify the HIV treatment, adding a drug like raltegravir and in patients that with well control, they didn't see a lot of changes in residual inflammation. The story is a little bit different if you add CCR5 antagonists like maraviroc. So if you add maraviroc, you decrease the residual levels of inflammation. The study was Wilkins. It was a study from the ACTG showed that if you add maraviroc to patients with well-controlled HIV, the inflammation goes down, but we don't know what is the long-term effect of that decreased level of inflammation. Would it benefit the patients in cardiovascular outcomes or CD4 outcomes or bone outcomes? That's the kind of thing that we still don't know. If we intervene in it to try to reduce these residual levels of inflammation, do we make a difference in the clinical outcome of the patients? And I think that's going to be an area of intensive research in the next few years.
Well, how sure are we even at this point that inflammation itself over the long term does result in actual clinical events that seriously impact the health and potentially threaten the lives of HIV-infected patients?
We don't know from the HIV. We know that antiretroviral therapy works very well and decreases morbidity and mortality in patients with HIV infection. We don't know what is the price that we pay for having this low-level inflammation. If we look at other fields like cardiology or geriatrics, inflammation has been associated with outcomes. If you look at the cardiovascular literature, C-reactive protein, people with C-reactive protein, which is a surrogate marker of inflammation, people with higher C-reactive proteins have a higher risk of developing cardiovascular events. For decades now, we know that atherosclerosis has a strong inflammatory component for both the progression and the risk of rupture of the plaque, the atheroma plaque, and the cardiovascular events associated with that are triggered by inflammation. There was a study published a couple of years ago in the New England Journal, the Jupiter study, that I think is probably like a proof of concept of the type of interventions that we are going to be using in patients with HIV infection. So in that study, patients with normal lipids, so they have cholesterol that were in the normal range, but that had high levels of inflammation measured by a high C-reactive protein. In that study, they were randomized to receive statin, simvastatin or not, and there was a decrease in the incidence of cardiovascular events. So I think many groups around the globe are thinking in trying to add something to patients with HIV, something simple to take, probably like a statin, and see if that makes a difference in the long run for cardiovascular outcomes and other outcomes.
Well, how related is that to inflammation per se? I mean, we saw some data presented at CROI from the Everlasting DAD study about the impact of triglycerides on MI risk. How does that tie in with or compare to the impact of inflammation on potential cardiovascular risk?
I think both are part of or contributors to the increased cardiovascular risk that we see in patients with HIV. The alterations in the lipids that are seen associated with some drugs that we use for the treatment of HIV and also the residual inflammation. The data from the DAD in this particular CROI refer to, I mean, the question they try to answer is, does hypertriglyceridemia, which is a risk factor for cardiovascular events, not as powerful as cholesterol, predicts the risk of cardiovascular events in patients with HIV? And the answer is probably yes, it predicts, but is much less powerful than cholesterol in predicting cardiovascular events. So I think the conclusion for the clinician from that trial is that if you have to focus on something and try to decrease the cardiovascular risk of the patient that is in front of you, you better focus on lowering their total cholesterol and try to reach LDL goals, that you will get more benefit if you follow that approach than if you try to chase triglyceride levels. I usually worry about triglycerides when they are over 500 or over 1,000 because of the increased risk of pancreatitis. But many or most of my patients have triglycerides in the 200 to 300 range, and I usually don't worry too much about that. I recommend diet, basically, and some, for some people, maybe adding fish oil. But I don't worry too much about that if the LDL cholesterol goals are within range and if the patient is not a smoker. So I try to focus on other cardiovascular risk factors rather than in the triglycerides.
Well, that seems to get to the heart of what DAD has essentially been all about over the past few years, namely that, sure, there does appear to be some kind of relationship between cardiovascular risk and certain antiretrovirals. It's just that the overall risk of these kinds of things is still lower, right, than something like smoking or BMI or having a family history of cardiovascular disease, that kind of a thing.
Yeah, I think the traditional risk factors play a stronger role than some of the treatment-related factors, and we shouldn't forget that HIV by itself is a very strong predictor of cardiovascular risk. An old paper from Sanbo City in the New England Journal showed that when we started highly active antiretroviral therapy, the risk of cardiovascular events went down dramatically. We tended to forget about that because we focus a lot on the lipid abnormalities associated with some of the HIV treatments, but that was a study that was done more than a decade ago, and it was a very strong result. And then when the SMART study was presented, showing that when you stop antiretroviral therapy, in fact, you see an increase of the cardiovascular events, I think that reminded us that the benefits of therapy in reducing cardiovascular events and the risk of having uncontrolled viremia. Remember that the SMART study was done, that randomized people to viral load-driven therapy versus CD4-driven therapy, that you would start and stop therapy based on your CD4 cell count, was developed in part as a response to the perceived increased risk of cardiovascular events associated with treatment. So there was a strategy to try to minimize total drug exposure, and it didn't work out because I think HIV is a more important risk factor than anything that you get from the treatment.
Is there a possibility then that we're making more of inflammation than it actually is? I mean, given that, as you said, antiretroviral therapy, when it's effective, when it really suppresses the virus well, significantly reduces inflammation risk. I mean, it's still there, but it's not necessarily as great. Is this really worth the amount of time and attention that we're currently paying on it and trying to figure out how to measure it, how to find markers that can accurately gauge it and figure out what to do about it?
Well, I mean, there is some of it. I think inflammation has been a little bit of the flavor of the last year or two, and I think eventually we will put it in adequate perspective. I think treatment of HIV reduces inflammation remarkably. There is residual inflammation that we don't know why is happening. There is some residual inflammation, not in everybody, in some patients, that have some residual levels of inflammation. And if we understand that, why it's happening, and we develop interventions to deal with it, we will probably learn something not only that will benefit not only HIV-positive patients, but it will benefit other people that have these inflammatory conditions that have been associated with cardiovascular events. I think eventually that this is the way we would look at this, is that treatment benefits patients. We should treat people earlier so we don't let them go with very, very high levels of inflammation or associated with high levels of HIV viremia. And then when the viremia goes down and inflammation goes down, well, we will have to develop interventions to deal with this residual level of inflammation. And I think that will be it. Yes, I think there has been an emphasis, maybe too much emphasis on this, but it's an interesting thing, and we can learn a lot about this disease process and other diseases, and I think that's why there is so much scientific interest in this area.
Now, the potential ramifications of this significant outpouring of scientific interest, though, is that a lot of HIV-infected people are reading about this research and are getting a sense that there's a lot going on in the area of inflammation, that it's potentially a big deal, and that there's this flurry of activity surrounding it. So as a practicing clinician, what do you tell an HIV-infected person who comes to you and who maybe has been living with HIV for 5, 10, 15, 20 years and is on treatment and maybe doing okay, but is really concerned about all of this research that is coming out saying that inflammation is a problem and it doesn't seem to be going away even when you're on really good treatment?
Well, I try to put this into perspective with the patient. I think the best interventions to reduce inflammation are relatively simple. Eat healthy, do exercise. If you have cardiovascular disease, maybe taking a low-dose aspirin. If you smoke, definitely try to quit smoking. And if your lipids are a little bit high because of the HIV or its treatment, then do an intervention like a statin. And I think that at this point, it sounds like the most prudent recommendation. And if all my patients were able to quit smoking and stay that way, they will definitely decrease the levels of inflammation to a reasonable level. And I don't think they will have a dramatic increase in the cardiovascular risk. In fact, there is some data that suggests that the risk of MIs in patients with HIV that are well controlled and they are taking these new medicines that are less associated with lipid problems and that they are being monitored and getting statins and quitting smoking, the risk of cardiovascular risk is approaching the one in the general population, which is still very high and which still we have to do something about it. But you are basically going to have down the road the same risk as anybody else for cardiovascular events. Drink a little bit of red wine a night and enjoy life. That's what I try to tell them.
Then let's shift gears a bit over into another complication that, an area of complications that has actually, it's always been a concern in HIV medicine, but the specific nature of those concerns has changed significantly, at least in the past decade compared to the decade prior to it, and that's cancers in HIV. AIDS-defining cancers, of course, were one of the, by definition, defining features of people with advanced HIV disease in the 80s and 90s. In, I guess, the more modern era of treatment, at least in developed countries, the nature of cancers that have been diagnosed in HIV-infected people has shifted a bit in terms of incidence and frequency of certain cancers, particularly non-AIDS-defining cancers in HIV-infected people. What did we learn at CROI that might add to our knowledge of where this might be headed?
I think this is an area that we need to be concerned about because patients with HIV are living longer and we need to worry about the long-term consequences of living with an immune system that is good enough to protect you from opportunistic infections, but maybe not completely normal, that will protect you from cancers and other long-term complications. I think there were several studies. I mean, there were data from the NAACOR, which is a large cohort of North America clinics. There were studies from the CDC, from the VA. And the general theme is that not only traditionally HIV-associated cancers are increasing HIV patients, I mean, it's not only Kaposi sarcoma or non-Hodgkin's lymphoma or Hodgkin lymphoma, that there are other cancers that we traditionally don't think of them as HIV-related, that in fact the incidence is increased in patients with HIV or they appear at a younger age in patients with HIV than in the general population. And I'm talking about lung cancer, liver cancer, cancer of the anal area, although that probably is associated with HIV, melanoma. So all these cancers, if you have HIV, your relative risk of having those cancers are probably twice or a little bit more than in the general population. There are two ways to deal with this. What does this mean for the clinician? It means, one, that probably is a good idea to treat earlier at HIV, because it seems that the increased incidence of this cancer is because your immune system is not completely normalized by treatment. But if you treat earlier, you will not allow your immune system to deteriorate to the point that you will lose some of these surveillance capabilities for cancer. So I think it's another one of the reasons, and the growing number of reasons that would tilt the balance to treat earlier, to try to prevent these long-term complications. The other message is, as HIV has become more of a chronic disease, you need to be aware of this problem and to stick to preventive measures, to really do your colonoscopy when you get to age 50, to really do, if you're a woman, pap smears to rule out cervical cancer. If you are a gay man, maybe to do pap smear of the perianal area to make sure that you are not going to have a rectal cancer. And if you have warts, maybe have them check more frequently by a colorectal surgeon. I think the awareness about this problem should increase screening frequency and make sure that you not only take care of your HIV, but also you have a regular internist that is going to be following up on these risks. And if you have a chronic cough, you have to have a chest x-ray to make sure that you are not developing lung cancer. Some of my patients, what happens is that they tend to go to the HIV clinic and they see their HIV doctor, and the HIV doctor tells them, oh, everything is going fine, you have an undetectable viral load, and your CD4 count is fine, keep doing what you are doing. Well, they should be telling the patients, let's start worried about traditional risk factors for cardiovascular disease, but also cancer. So I think the HIV care is becoming more and more like internal medicine, and that we need to address all these issues that are being associated with living longer with HIV, with well-controlled HIV.
Well, I imagine there's also a pretty delicate balance to strike here, though, because particularly for maybe a newly diagnosed patient who you, on the one hand, don't want to freak out. I mean, it's probably a big enough thing for them to be dealing with their HIV diagnosis, period, and with the concept of starting antiretroviral therapy and then having to continue to take that every single day for the rest of their lives, potentially. To also throw onto that the prospect of a variety of cancers potentially developing earlier or being more common among HIV-positive people and the need to then get screened more frequently. I think particularly maybe in the case of anal pap smears, where I had the opportunity to speak with Elizabeth Chow, who presented a couple studies on squamous cell cancer and the impact of antiretroviral therapy on maybe preventing it and the nature of it. And one of the assertions that she had made during the conversation we had was that, you know, anal pap smears aren't exactly, people don't love getting them. It's a difficult thing in some cases, and I think the same might be true of other types of cancer screenings. You're not necessarily going to get people to agree to get regularly tested for these sorts of things. What does the clinician say to a patient who, number one, might not have thought they would have to deal with this prospect, and then number two, might be not so thrilled with the idea of frequent cancer screenings?
You know, I try to have a very relaxed approach about this and I joke about my age, that I have to have my own colonoscopies, and nobody enjoys having a prostate exam, believe me, but you have to do it. You have to do screenings that have been proven to be effective. I mean, mammograms after the age of 50, colonoscopy after the age of 50, well, there is a big discussion about mammograms, but I mean, definitely after the age of 50, the pap smears, all these type of regular screenings, I think patients with HIV shouldn't forget about them. When everything is going well under HIV, they still have to realize that their immune system is not 100% normal, and that because of that, they need to be aware of it and deal with it. And the way to deal with it is to make sure that they encourage their physicians to do these regular things that we should be doing for everybody, but particularly for patients with HIV. And I try to have a very light approach to it, but I encourage my patients to make sure, I mean, that to have all these things done at regular intervals. And I think for some of the big programs like Medicare, Medicaid, they should really evaluate the quality of the HIV care that clinicians provide to HIV patients, not only by HIV markers, like how many people are taking antiretroviral, how many people are undetectable, but how good the providers are covering all these other areas. Because overall, I think we have to have a global approach to HIV care that includes dealing with this increased cardiovascular risk. Now we're talking about the increased cancer risk in this population. When I look at these things, I also hope that people that are not infected, they realize that HIV, although we have had huge improvements in antiretroviral treatment, that is not trivial. Your immune system is paying a price because if you have HIV, even if it's well controlled. Yes, we have better treatments for the treatment of HIV, but there is all over these increased risks that because of HIV are still present. And hopefully that message gets out, because I think the perception that HIV is a disease for the long run has been lost, and I think that's at least partially the reason why we still have more than 50,000 cases of new infections a year, that people don't think about the long-term consequences about having HIV. They say, well, if I get HIV, I will take a pill and everything will be fine. No, not exactly that. You still have an increased cardiovascular risk that I think we can deal with if we do regular interventions, and you still have an increase in risk cancer that is going to make you having to go to your provider periodically.
Well, it also appears, and we saw a number of studies at CROI that said much the same thing about bone disease and related complications.
Yeah, this is an area that I am interested because many years ago now, we did the observation that patients with HIV are more prone to have low bone mineral density than the general population, and somewhat that this problem is not only related to HIV, but also to the treatment of HIV. And I think there were important studies presented at CROI. There was a study by basically the HOPS cohort from the CDC and also a study from the aging cohort from the VA, Julie Womack, I think, showing that patients with HIV are an increased risk of fractures when you compare it to the general population. There was a study of WISE, the women cohort, that didn't show that. Although that group, that cohort, is a little bit younger and is women, premenopausal women. So I was not very surprised that they didn't see an increase in risk fracture. And the other thing that I think we don't understand very well yet is osteopenia and osteoporosis is much more common in males with HIV than in women. So it's exactly the opposite of what we see in the general population, and we don't know why. So that was one of the messages regarding bone, that patients with HIV are at increased risk of fracture. And then there was a large presentation from Grace McKenzie of a huge ACTG study, 52-4, that looked at the effects of antiretroviral therapy on the bone. So when you start antiretroviral therapy, and this is completely independent of the regimen, whenever you start antiretroviral therapy, the patients lose between 2 and 4% of their total bone mass. And this is independent of the regimen. If you start a regimen that includes tenofovir, you lose a little bit more than if you start a regimen that doesn't include tenofovir. And this happens quickly. And then after 24 to 48 weeks, the bone mineral density tends to stabilize. This is similar to what happens when you start steroids, although to a lesser degree. When you start steroids, you lose around 10% of your bone mass. When you start antiretroviral therapy, you lose around 3% to 4% of your bone mass. This is another thing that the patients with HIV should be aware of, that because of their HIV and because of the treatment, they are at increased risk of osteopenia and osteoporosis. And I think, again, it's something that the clinician has to deal with. And basically, I think patients that are older than 50, that they have HIV infection, should have a DEXA scan and see where they stand. And if they have indications for treatment, then they might need to be treated. And if they have a normal bone mineral density, then we need to do the standard things that we suggest to everybody that is under medical care. I mean, taking out calcium, taking out vitamin D. By the way, the frequency of low vitamin D levels is extremely high, not only in HIV-positive patients. There were studies from the U.S., from Switzerland, from other countries, proving that the prevalence of low vitamin D is very high among HIV, but it's also very high in the general population. So increase the vitamin D intake is something important that patients need to do for their bone health. But because of this increased risk of osteopenia and osteoporosis with HIV, I think it's also important that people get diagnosed, and I would do a DEXA in everybody that is older than 50. If it's younger than 50, I don't think it's indicated because the risk of fracture is relatively low because these patients are independent and they don't have a risk of falling. But as you age and you become older than 50, or particularly if you become older than 60 and 70, or 70, is when you start having frailty and your risk of falling and then fracturing something is higher. And that is associated with, ultimately, with a lot of morbidity and mortality. So I think the message is that osteopenia is common, and osteoporosis, that we have to deal with it, and that as in the general population, the presence of low bone mineral density measured by DEXA is associated with an increased risk of fractures.
Just to clarify, you wouldn't necessarily suggest any kind of screening intervention unless a patient is over the age of 50. If they're younger, is it more you should just be taking preventive measures at that point, but you should be actively doing something to ensure that you don't develop problems when you're older?
Yes, it's not only my, it's the National Osteoporosis Foundation recommendation. So if you are older than 50, you should have a DEXA if you have a risk factor for osteopenia and osteoporosis. And I think HIV infection by itself is a risk factor for osteopenia and osteoporosis. So I would say anybody with HIV, man or woman, older than 50 should have a DEXA. Younger than 50, I think general health measures to improve bone health is the way to go. If you have had a fracture, I mean, if you have HIV and you have had a fracture before, independently on your age, you should have a DEXA. So if you fell down the stairs and you fractured your wrist and you were 40 and you have HIV and you're taking medicine, you should have a DEXA because you might have osteopenosteoporosis. You might have been just the accident and doesn't have anything to do with your bone health. But there is no way to know except doing a DEXA. But in general, my recommendation would be for the general population of HIV positive, I would do a DEXA in everybody that is older than 50. And that's the recommendation for the general population if you have a risk factor for the disease. And as I said, I think HIV is a risk factor. It's not included in the list of the National Osteoporosis Foundation because probably it was an oversight, but definitely patients with HIV are at increased risk of osteoporosis, and now we know, thanks to some of the presentations at CROI, that they are also at increased risk of fractures.
Speaking of complications that tend to emerge as HIV-infected patients age, we saw a number of studies that were presented at CROI having to do with CNS complications, which seems to be the issue that never dies. I mean, it's age-related dementia was a key concern a decade or more ago, and now we're seeing a number of different signs of CNS-related problems emerging over time in HIV-infected people, despite suppressive antiretroviral therapy.
Yeah, there were several presentations from the CHARTER cohort, which is a large cohort, around 1,500 patients, in San Diego and multiple other sites in the U.S., showing that in spite of virologic controls, a sizable number of patients with HIV have what they call HAN, HIV-associated neurologic dysfunction is the name. This is a subtle neurocognitive impairment. You might not notice it in the activities of your daily living, and you can only ascertain it if you do some of the sophisticated tests that are done as part of this cohort study. A significant proportion of patients with HIV infection have this HAND, HIV-associated neurologic dysfunction, and as it's not completely corrected, although it's definitely improved with antiretroviral treatment. And some of the suggestions of the posters and the presentations that were made during the CROI meeting were that if you treat earlier HIV infection, and there was a theme about that, that you decrease the risk of this HAND. If your native CD4 count is higher, the probability of you developing this neurocognitive impairment is lower. So it's another one of the reasons to try to push people to think about treating HIV earlier, to try to prevent these long-term complications. We talk first about cardiovascular complications, we talk later about cancers, and now we are talking about this neurocognitive impairment. One of the things that people have been talking a lot in the last few years is, do we need to use medications that penetrate well in the CNS, in the spinal fluid? And there was a study from England, I thought it was, looking at individuals that had started antiretroviral therapy that penetrated well on the CSF versus individuals that started antiretroviral regimens that didn't penetrate that well on the CSF. And it didn't make a big difference on the frequency of this neurocognitive impairment. The penetration in the CSF might not be that relevant when the drugs get into the brain, I mean, in the tissue, as opposed to crossing the blood-brain barrier and getting into the CSF. So obviously we're not going to be doing biopsies of the brain in people, so probably any drug that suppress viral replication probably is active within the brain tissue, even if it doesn't cross the blood-brain barrier. But there is a lot of people that, particularly neurologists, that think we should try to give medications that penetrate well in the CSF. I don't think the evidence is there yet to prove that that prevents these neurocognitive impairment. And in fact, I think the evidence is the other way around, that any drug that will suppress viral replication will decrease the risk of these complications.
So if you have a patient who's on suppressive antiretroviral therapy and maybe has been for, let's say, 15 years or so, or even longer, but is starting to develop some symptoms of potentially some early onset dementia, like maybe they're developing some memory problems or similar CNS-related issues, you wouldn't suggest maybe a shift to a drug that has been found through study to penetrate the blood-brain barrier a little bit better?
I mean, in a situation like that, you start worrying about other causes of dementia, vascular or degenerative Alzheimer's, or you have to do a real workup for dementia before blaming it into the drugs that do not penetrate on the CNS. So a patient that has neurocognitive impairment, in spite of successful antiretroviral therapy, I think needs a complete workup by an HIV doctor, but also by a good neurologist to try to rule out other causes of dementia that patients with HIV are not protected from. I mean, patients with HIV are aging like the general population, and they will have the problems that the general population has. And if in the course of that evaluation, which probably will include an MRI and probably a spinal tap, I will measure the viral load on the CSF fluid, and if it's positive and it's different from the general circulation, probably I will change the antiretroviral therapy. If the viral load is undetectable in the CSF as is in the serum, then I would probably think that the cause of that neurocognitive impairment doesn't have anything to do with ongoing HIV infection, and probably will not adjust necessarily the antiretroviral regimen that the patient is taking. But I think it's something that we need to worry about to make sure that we monitor for it, and if it appears, then consider a more thorough evaluation of the neurocognitive function and possibly other causes that can be associated with neurocognitive impairment.
I suppose, as with all things, there's a certain amount of perspective that this needs to be placed in. I mean, you had mentioned earlier in our talk about CNS issues that the studies that were presented here generally found that we're talking about very subtle shifts, right, in CNS function. We're not talking about anything that's necessarily something that a person would even notice in their day-to-day lives. So it's not something that we necessarily need to actively monitor, that an HIV-infected patient, the average patient, even needs to be that concerned about, right?
I agree with you completely. It's not that our clinics are full of patients with severe neurocognitive impairment that cannot drive to the clinic. This is not what we saw in 1990, 1991, when the HIV dementia was so prevalent and so disheartening, because many, many people were developing it and where HIV was progressing and they were losing all their mental capabilities. I think if you had come to our office or any office with HIV, patients with severe neurologic dysfunctions are rare. Occasionally we have some, but in general, patients, the effects of antiretroviral treatment has been incredible, and basically AIDS-associated dementia has almost disappeared from our clinics. I mean, in some neurology clinics, I'm sure that they see some of it, but as soon as we start treating with HIV, with potent antiretroviral therapy, and you control HIV replication, then severe neurocognitive impairment tend to improve, and then you're left with these subtle abnormalities that you just have to monitor and deal with them. And usually patients can deal with them with extra support from their surroundings, and if they have small memory losses, there are tricks to go around it. And probably that's why one of the reasons why the GPSs for cars have become so popular.
So then taking a step back, we just spent a good amount of time really wading through a marsh of a significant number of studies that talk about essentially long-term impact of HIV and maybe to an extent antiretroviral therapy on a range of different key complications, you know, cardiovascular, inflammation, cancers, bone issues, CNS, potentially CNS issues. All of this gets at something that you said a little bit earlier in our conversation about how it seems to be the nature of what it means to be an HIV care provider seems to really be changing. I mean, the nature of these studies presented at CROI don't revolve so much around these specific issues of which drug to take. It's becoming more about the management of all of the other things that a person might encounter as they live with and deal with the impact of HIV.
Hey, you're absolutely right. I mean, if anything, this CROI meeting was about the complications of HIV and its treatment more than new antiretroviral drugs. There were no earth-shattering new antiretroviral treatments or paradigm shifts on the treatment of HIV. And the general theme of this CROI meeting was about the complications of HIV, cardiovascular, cancer. There was even a session about H1N1, CNS, bone disease. So, and yes, the nature of being an HIV doctor is shifting for a while. For a few years, we needed to know about all the antiretroviral medications, the resistance patterns, and we still need to know about all that, but now it's becoming much more general internal medicine. You have to deal with all these things. You have to learn how to manage them and to be proactive in managing them. Being a provider is going to be different in different states or even different paying environments. Sometimes HIV providers are also the primary care provider for the patient. If that's the case, they have to take full responsibility for monitoring for all these other issues. In some states or in some markets, the HIV provider is a specialist where the patient is just referred to them for HIV care. What happens is that the patients usually see their HIV provider 4 or 5 times a year, and they might see their primary care provider only 1 time a year. It will really be a pity and a waste of opportunities if the HIV provider doesn't try to do some interventions to improve the overall health of their patients. So I think for the HIV providers, we're going to become more and more general internists taking care of HIV patients, which I think is a good development because I like internal medicine, to tell you the truth.
Well, isn't this a bit of a tall order to ask of practicing HIV physicians or maybe just ID docs who take care of some HIV-infected patients to suddenly need to take on knowledge and understanding of a wide range of other areas?
Well, yeah, it might be a tall order, but I think is the nature of the thing. And I think the HIV providers in general have been very adaptable and have adapted themselves to the changing circumstances of HIV care. And I think this is going to be the way of the next decade until we find a cure for HIV, that we're going to have to deal with all these other complications. And hopefully this challenge will attract people into HIV care and young physicians into HIV care, which I have been worried about losing some of the romantic ideas about HIV from the early 90s that attracted many young physicians into HIV care. We have not seen that on the last 5 years, and I think if residents and new physicians see that HIV care is a challenge, that it will require a very broad knowledge base, but in addition to that, you have all the science and all the excitement of the antiretroviral treatment, I hope we can attract new providers into our field, because what is really a fact is that the number of patients with HIV is going to grow because of increased survival, and that we are going to need more and more providers taking care of these patients. And I hope we can attract the providers and this new challenge of having to have a global knowledge, global perspective will attract some clinicians, because the population of HIV providers is aging and we need younger people doing this.
Are you listening, med students of the United States and Europe?
Today is Match Day in the U.S., so I don't know if they will be listening, but maybe in the future they will. They probably are celebrating or very worried where they match.
Well, it sounds like if they end up at UPenn that they'll be in pretty good hands. It sounds like you might be the kind of person who would try to take a more aggressive stance on their training to get them to take more things into account than just HIV specifically.
Yes, and I think that's one of the most attractive things of being an HIV care provider, that you have to have a holistic approach to your patient, that you just cannot focus exclusively on HIV issues, that all of these issues that people in the past thought that were not related to HIV, you know what? It was related to HIV, and it is related to HIV. I mean, the increased cancers, the increased cardiovascular disease, the bone, all of that is somewhat related to HIV and its treatment, and you need also to deal with those.
Pablo Tebas is an associate professor of medicine at the University of Pennsylvania School of Medicine. Dr. Tebas, thank you so much for taking the time to talk.
Well, you're more than welcome.
The opinions expressed by hosts or interviewees in this podcast do not constitute professional advice, should not be considered substitutes for professional services, and do not necessarily represent the opinions of Body Health Resources Corporation or its sponsors. Please see the full disclaimer online at thebodypro.com. If you have comments or questions, please contact us.
Thank you for listening to this report from CROI 2010. For more coverage of this conference, please visit us online at thebodypro.com/CROI2010.